You're listening to Classic Dialogues, Land Power in the Indo-Pacific, a China Land Power Studies Center production. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. My guest today is Dr. Sheena Chestnut Greitens, author of Politics of the North Korean Diaspora, which was released in December 2023. Greitens is associate professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, where she directs UT's Asia Policy Program. She's currently serving as a visiting associate professor of research in Indo-Pacific security at the U.S. Army War College's China Land Power Studies Center at the Strategic Studies Institute. She's also concurrently a non-resident scholar with the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome to Classic Dialogues, Sheena.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first off, congratulations on your recently published book. What inspired you to write this? Why now?
You know, this book has been about a decade in coming. Starting in about 2004, 2005, I had begun interviewing a lot of North Korean refugees and defectors for projects on North Korea's involvement in drug trafficking and counterfeiting, both as a source of revenue for the North Korean regime, but also because this had created links to transnational networks. And at the time, there was some real concern that North Korea could export nuclear material or components of its nuclear weapons program using these transnational criminal organizations. That was, you know, a past research project, but I was really struck by the challenge and some of the stories of the people who had left North Korea and were trying to build new lives in South Korea, often without a lot of family support. Some were eventually able to bring family, others not. And I was just really interested in the piece that sort of what happened after. I spent a long time asking specific questions about North Korea, the place they'd left, but I was actually increasingly interested as I got to know them as people and as colleagues in the lives that they had built after they left. And so that was originally one of the motivations for the book. And then there's a moment I talk about at the very end of the book manuscript where I was in a city on the North Korea-China border talking to a woman who had grown up inside North Korea and went back and forth between China and North Korea a lot for work. And she said to me this comment that I've always remembered, which is, you know, you and I are free, but people are in North Korea are not. And China was very different then, but it was still fairly jarring to a young graduate student to hear Chinese people and Americans grouped together as free people. So I found that really striking, that that was her perception of the difference between leaving North Korea, even if you get to a place like China. But North Korean defectors in South Korea talked about China as one of the most difficult places that they had to transit. And some of them had to live in China for a long time in very precarious or vulnerable positions. I was really interested in questions about how people who left one of the world's most authoritarian political systems thought about freedom and democracy once they actually experienced it wherever they went. And so the book tried to unpack that question and those stories, but it was really the human element of this that sparked my interest.
How has North Korea's approach to managing its diaspora evolved over time?
You know, the North Korean diaspora during the Cold War was really strongly pro-regime. It was affiliated with the North Korean, the Kim family regime in Pyongyang, largely because it was composed of North Korean diplomats or trading companies or pro-Juche North Korean friendship societies abroad. And it was very both regime aligned, but also regime controlled. And what happened after the end of the Cold War with economic crisis and famine in North Korea and a breakdown of the public distribution system that provided food, but also the internal controls on movement and a breakdown in border security with China, is that an increasing number of people who didn't like what had happened in North Korea chose to leave. Some of them seek political freedom. Some of them were simply seeking economic survival. But you had a large number of people, increasingly women, who weren't required to report to factories during the famine, like the men were, who could go out and seek to do black market trading or cross into China to marry Chinese men voluntarily or often involuntarily. And so the composition of the diaspora really changed. As that happened, North Korea's approach adapted because the diaspora became less supportive and more threatening. And so today, as I talk about in the book, the North Korean regime uses what I call three pillars to manage its diaspora. The first is to dissuade people from leaving. Even compared to other autocracies, North Korea works really hard to keep people from getting out. And that actually makes North Korea globally unusual, even among other dictatorships. The second factor is that then once people leave, if they try to speak out publicly, North Korea goes to great lengths to discredit them. It discredits them in international fora like the UN. It discredits them in the media that it distributes domestically inside the DPRK to the citizens who remain in the country, but works really hard to discredit and tarnish the reputations and the character of anybody who does leave. And it uses the term human scum to refer to them as a category. And then the third pillar is that it really tries to deter the diaspora from becoming a site of anti-regime mobilization. So one of the things we learned from the Arab Spring is that diaspora communities can be financial, digital, logistical supports to opposition movements in country. And North Korea has worked pretty hard to try to prevent an organized opposition abroad from becoming big and capable, but also has tried to prevent that diaspora from connecting to people in country to avoid that process of these external diaspora members being a support for on-the-ground opposition in country. And so that deterrence can take a bunch of forms, from limiting communication and censorship to threatening phone calls to ordinary North Koreans who've made it to Seoul and are trying to call family or send medicine or food or money to their families inside the DPRK. Or it can even take the form of really severe forms of extraterritorial repression, like the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, Kim Jong-un's half-brother, in a Malaysian airport a couple of years ago. So those are the kind of the set of tools that North Korea uses. But that's really emerged in response to this increasing sense of the diaspora as a potential political threat to the regime.
What factors shape where defectors go?
That's a great question. One of the sort of data points that I got interested in early on in writing this book is that a lot of North Koreans used to go solely to South Korea. In South Korea, the South Korean constitution and nationality law sort of in combination define anyone born in the territory of the DPRK as a South Korean citizen. And so there's this idea that North Koreans who get there get, you sometimes hear the phrase automatic citizenship. It turns out if you look at that experience of trying to get to South Korea and then to claim citizenship through the eyes of North Koreans making that trip, it does not feel automatic at all. It feels precarious, contingent, depending on the year and the place. South Korean embassies have not always been particularly friendly to North Koreans who approach them for help, in part because they're worried about the geopolitical consequences of diplomatic relations with that host country, particularly China. I will say that's actually changed under the most recent administration, at least a bit, and it'll be interesting to see where that goes. The first factor is this availability of South Korean citizenship. You know, it is a place where the Korean language is spoken, and there's this political narrative that political elites in both the South Korea and North Korea have had for a long time of one Korean people linked by a shared bloodline and shared ethnicity. But increasingly, we've started to see North Koreans go abroad, either directly from China or Southeast Asia, go to the United States, go to Europe, go somewhere else, Canada, Japan sometimes, if they have a connection to Japan. Or they'll go to South Korea. Maybe the experience isn't as unifying and welcoming as they'd expected. And so then they seek opportunities to go get the educational capital of a European or an American or North American education, or improve their English language proficiency, which is still important for success in South Korea. So we started to see both direct migration to other places around the world and some onward migration from South Korea that really started to globalize the South Korean diaspora. The limiting factor has often actually been asylum courts, which have said, as the refugee regime has come under increased strain, hey, you've got a South Korean citizenship available to you. That's a safe place. They believe you're a citizen. You need to go there and not come to the UK or Canada, to take two major examples. And so it's actually been difficult for North Koreans to claim refugee status in a lot of European countries or Canada, some other places, because of this availability of South Korean citizenship. So this gets into kind of complicated stuff about domestic and citizenship laws and how third-party courts view it. The result of all of this kind of messy process over time has been what the book called a T-shaped diaspora. So it's a deep sort of community of North Korean refugees and defectors in South Korea who've been coming there since really the Cold War, but these global anchor communities in other places. And the book talks about that in part because those anchor communities turn out to have been really important later for transnational advocacy campaigns. So I think it's worth explaining this very complicated process of how they got there.
Once the North Korean escapees make it to their new home, their democratic society that they're aiming to get to, how do they understand their roles within the societies?
This was one of the questions that I was most interested in talking to, you know, North Koreans in particular who had come to the United States and become Americans. In the book, I actually go through the results of a survey that was a survey of North Koreans in the United States and ask them some questions about citizenship that we often ask the broader population of American citizens or other immigrant communities, as well as North Koreans in South Korea. And one of the things that was really interesting and apparent to me was how much the North Korean respondents in the survey had internalized the norms of American democracy. They might feel a communal or a familial attachment to the Korean peninsula, but that coexisted alongside this really strong civic attachment to being American and the privileges and the rights that came with that. And that was actually just really neat to see these individual quotes and stories from people about how they understood that. So that was the first thing, is just sort of how strongly the norms of democratic citizenship came out in the responses that people gave. Second of all, scholars of citizenship often talk about civil citizenship, the right to be protected from government overreach or abuse, participatory citizenship, which is like voting and electoral components of democracy. How do you participate as a citizen? And then economic components. Does citizenship have a socioeconomic welfare component? And what was interesting is that North Koreans really emphasize the civil components of citizenship. It's really important to a lot of North Korean respondents that as a citizen, they have a right and the government has a responsibility to protect them from overreach or abuse. And then second, that the participatory elements are pretty important. North Koreans tend to participate in democratic processes at higher than average rates compared to the American baseline population. So I thought that was also really interesting. Maybe not surprising that people who had been often oppressed or repressed by the North Korean government would find that a really important component of citizenship. But, you know, these were also people whose socioeconomic welfare system failed to the point of starvation for many, either them or their immediate family members. And yet we didn't see quite the same emphasis on the socioeconomic dimensions of citizenship. It was much more this classic kind of civil liberties dimension of what the rights of a citizen and the obligations of a government were. I didn't have a strong prior coming in, but I found that emphasis really interesting to listen to people and understand where it came from.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about how North Koreans who have resettled show high levels of civic engagement and political participation. Can you tell me more about that, please?
Yeah, sure. With respect to domestic politics, North Korean refugees and defectors in both South Korea and the United States tend to vote at higher levels than the average electorate, the average eligible voting population. That was sort of one interesting finding that we could compare South Korea and the United States, and it was consistent in both places. Voting was often really meaningful. So was getting a passport, actually, the ability to hold a passport that identified you as a citizen and you could take to other countries and that identified you as an American in the world, which I found really interesting. But the other thing is that North Koreans do other forms of political participation, often things like sharing information with communities online, but also going and talking to civic groups or meeting with local officials, members of Congress, et cetera. That was also really interesting that it's not just limited to showing up on election day to vote, but that there's this broader pattern of taking advantage of the rights and privileges that come with democratic citizenship. Again, not super surprising, but honestly fairly inspiring at times when you listen to the stories that went along with it. And then the second part of this is that often there are a number of North Koreans who've become very prominent transnational advocates or international advocates for North Korean human rights and policy changes toward their North Korean homeland. The book talks a little bit about how these two have been reinforcing, having communities where people can participate in local democratic politics or national democratic politics as citizens can sometimes provide a base of support then for these international connections and campaigns on North Korean human rights among North Korean diaspora groups in, say, Japan and South Korea and the United States and the UK and Canada, and people all sort of collaborating and learning from each other. And that was particularly important in forming and then getting the sort of evidentiary basis for the UN Commission of Inquiry, which was 10 years ago in 2014 on human rights in North Korea. But then, you know, a number of folks who did a lot of international advocacy have also then returned to whatever country they reside in and run for local or national office. So this transnational or international advocacy can also then spur someone to take on a role of domestic political leadership. So these things intersect and are mutually reinforcing in really interesting ways. And again, the book goes into more detail on that.
What do your findings mean for the United States and its approach to the region?
There are a couple of important findings. The book talks about North Koreans stepping into three roles. They've been witnesses for a past that the regime has often tried to cover up and hide, particularly with respect to human rights violations. They're representatives in the present moment because the North Korean people, again, can't speak for themselves on an international stage, can't often get access to media. Media reporting in North Korea is highly, highly limited, if nearly non-existent at some points in the last couple of years. And then they are also stakeholders in whatever the future of North Korea and the Korean Peninsula holds. And that's a really heavy responsibility. And so I think one of the implications is just to sort of put North Korea into this broader conversation on transnational repression. And the North Korean regime really does engage in a high level of transnational repression. It's got a very small diaspora and it's not a powerful country, but the amount of transnational repression that it engages in is really, I think, worth noting on human rights grounds and advocacy grounds. Second is that this community of North Koreans has played these different roles. They are a resource for the U.S. and the international community. And I think this is a potential area of cooperation for the U.S. and the ROK alliance, particularly because the Yoon government has talked about values-based diplomacy and has raised the issue of protecting North Korean refugees and defectors around the world more effectively. So I think that's something that the U.S. could support South Korean leadership on in a very meaningful way and strengthen the alliance in the process. Third, maybe as a little bit of a cautionary note. We tended to look at the Arab Spring and see a lot of potential for diasporic activism and regime transformation. And the cases that I focus on, there have been some real advocacy successes, particularly around the United Nations Commission of Inquiry. But North Korea is a much more closed and hardened authoritarian regime than a lot of the regimes we were talking about and looking at in the Arab Spring. And I think we need to recognize that it's really hard for diasporic opposition and activism to affect complete regime transformation without some other factors coming into play. And I mention that because I don't want people to think that I'm suggesting that groups of North Korean emigres can go in and replace the Kim regime tomorrow. That's not the lesson from the book. It's about more limited and incremental gains for activism and advocacy that transform individual lives and are still very meaningful. But I do want to be careful that it doesn't get interpreted as suggesting that diasporic activism can deliver more than is reasonable to expect of a population that is already operating under severe limits and with a lot of loss due to the separation from family and communities in their homeland. So I think there's a cautionary piece in the book about the limits there that policymakers need to understand and respect to craft policies that might actually effectuate meaningful change. The hope is that the book is a resource for that and a starting point for that conversation, as well as for trying to link North Korea and bring it into these conversations that we're increasingly having about how to handle the challenges of transnational repression. Those are really the key findings that I wanted to draw out and focus on.
Do you have any concluding thoughts you'd like to share?
There was both a political science question about democratic citizenship and how authoritarianism shapes diaspora politics when I started the book, but also just this very human interest in the lives of people who've become, in some cases, our fellow citizens. I would like for the book to be a resource for people who are dealing with transnational repression, who are crafting policy responses. But I also wanted to show people what I thought the value of, in this case, a very small refugee resettlement program in the United States had been, and the kind of democratic citizens that it was producing. I thought that was interesting and really valuable to highlight. So I think there's both a policy and a human narrative contribution that I hope the book makes. Probably more of a niche publication, but I hope that for folks who pick it up, that they find something interesting in it.
On that note, where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
So there are a couple of pieces on my website, chinagreitens.com, that has some interviews and a couple of more policy-oriented short pieces about the book. The book itself is available from Cambridge and online. So it's both a hard copy short book and a downloadable PDF. Also, if anybody has trouble getting a hold of a copy, they're free to contact me And I'd be happy to make sure that they get either the abridged version or the full book if that's of interest. Thanks for asking.
Sure. And I'm assuming they can just contact you through your website if they need to reach out.
Sure. Or via my email address at UT. Either one works.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
For more Army War College podcasts, listeners, check out Decisive Point, Conversations on Strategy, and SSI Live.